Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Deanna Meyer, Fiona Cork, and Lear Key. Deanna Meyer is a longtime environmental activist and a board member of Deep Green Resistance, Prairie Protection, and the executive director of Prairie Protection Colorado. She's a goat and chicken farm, grows organic vegetables year-round, and lives with a beautiful forest and mountain meadow now filled with the jump yip of prairie dogs from a colony she helped save. She spends her time connecting with the land and fighting for her beloved. Fiona Cork is an Australian actor, wildlife advocate, and activist who's been campaign and creative director for the Australian Society for Kangaroo since 2008. She's also the creator and co-founder of the Wildlife Safe Certification Trademark. And Lear Keith has been a radical feminist for 40 years. She's the author of 6 books. The 7th, Bright Green Lies, will be out the end of February. So first off, thank all of you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. Hi, everyone.
Yes, hello, and thank you, Derek, for having us. This is great.
Hopefully we all have a lot of fun.
So today we're going to do something different. Instead of me just interviewing you, we're going to play with the Beneath and Beyond cards. And the Beneath and Beyond cards is a project that Fiona and I put out. The idea came maybe, 16, 17 years ago, 15 years ago, when I was at a restaurant and waiting at a table for my food, and they had Trivial Pursuit cards at the table. I'd never seen that before. I thought it was pretty cool. And then I thought, what if the questions were more important than literal trivia? And over the next few years, just whenever I'd think about it, I would come up with questions, and I ended up with 1,000. And the project sort of entered what I guess in Hollywood they call development hell, which is ideas are there, but it's not being produced. And then along came Fiona. What? How long ago was this now, Fiona? A couple years? Year and a half, maybe?
Yeah, I think it was about, it was probably about a year and a half ago, I think I asked you what we're going to do with all the questions. So we're on your reading club page, and you'd put them out in and somewhere else I'd seen them. Anyway, I thought they were very interesting.
And I said, I have no idea what I'm going to do with them. And then she took over.
That's right.
And cut out most of the questions and made up a whole bunch of new questions that were much better and fixed language and beautifully designed the cards. And it's out now. And what these cards are they are cards to spark conversations. As we say on the front, our hope is these cards can be a useful guide in discovering more about ourselves and our place in the world and the lives of others, both human and non-human. And our desire is these questions may evoke reflection, conversation, and discussion about what's most important in our relationship to this earth, to our friends and loved ones, and to ourselves. And so instead of just rambling more, why don't we start? Is everybody ready to mess around with them for a little while?
Sure.
Okay, yeah. So the idea will be, I'm just going to ask a question, and then you can, 1, 2, or 3 of you can answer as short or as long as you want. You can talk to each other. You can do whatever you want with it. First question is 2 questions together. What do you love, and what would you do to defend it? Since nobody's saying anything, how about you, Deanna?
Yeah, I've thought about this question because I've seen this card, and what do I love would be life. I mean, I can look at where I'm living directly. I really love the forest and the meadows and the plants and the prairie dogs and the bobcats and the elk and the soil. So, I mean, I love this living planet. And I would do anything really that I could to defend it within – you know, within the confines that we find ourselves in. And just like with the prairie dogs, I did everything. I just worked as hard as I could to draw attention to the diminishing like prairie dog colonies and one up here in particular, but many, many others, just to try to get everybody to defend it themselves as well, to defend life in any way that we can, by, you know, screaming at the top of our lungs about it and organizing. And the organizing piece is the most important I've found. And when people can do that, they can make a difference.
Wait, are you suggesting that organizing is more important than screaming?
Yeah, in some ways. And it's what we're, a lot of us are missing. But I mean, I think we all need to do a lot more than what we're doing now, if because we're in trouble. I mean, life is in trouble.
Great.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Fiona.
Oh, okay. Absolutely. Look, I totally agree with what Deanna said and feel very much the same way. It is about protecting life and life itself. I ended up protecting, I guess, wildlife, or most particularly kangaroos, as Deanna went to protect prairie dogs, because they were the ones that seemed most in trouble. And I like what Deanna just said then. It's about making other people aware that they will actually want to defend them themselves as well. And we've had a few experiences of that with saving kangaroos here in Australia, and working with small communities to save their own mobs from culling. And that's actually been really successful. And quite frankly, it's the only way forward so that we can save more and more quickly, is help and assist other people, and help them to be able to organise ways to save what they love as well, because a lot of people don't know. And I recall after one cull that we stopped quite a few years ago now, and it was in a small community just north of Melbourne here in Australia, and we had a bit of a get together after we'd saved the kangaroos. It was like a 7-month standoff with patrols on a roster system every night of the week for 7 months until the permit expired and they gave up wanting to shoot the kangaroos. But at the end of that, and to celebrate that victory, we thanked the local community for assisting, and for their efforts, and for all the cups of tea they made us, and the cakes, and the heating hot water bottles up for us, and giving us shelter at their places when we were hiding from police and guys with guns and stuff. And so we thanked them for that. And one guy stood up and he said, no, he said, we all actually want to thank you, because we never realised that we could actually save the kangaroos ourselves. We didn't think that we could do that. Now we know that we can, and we want to thank you for that. I'll never forget that, actually. It was very moving. And so that's in line with what Deanna was saying, is to take that one step more, is to assist other people in wanting to save what they love, and teaching them to defend what they love as well.
Yeah, and just this is Deanna again. I think that that's probably my best feeling right now with everything, is that when we do organize, get people to do these actions, lots of times, and many, even this year, we've had at least 4 or 5 victories where they've pulled back and said, we're not going to kill. And it gives people
fantastic.
It gives people that hope. That, you know what, we can make a change, and then we can, and my goal is to get people to feel like they can talk, organize, resist, and then bring that to the next level. Because so many people don't believe that small step can even happen. So if people can practice saving smaller community, whatever it is around you, and see, and get everybody else to say, if you put your energy into this, and if you put your passion into this, you can change the outcome. And if you can change that outcome, then look, we can change a bigger outcome, which is the, entire system, the dismantling of that system, and building people up into those, tiers of organized resistance. And we're still kind of at the bottom, but that's my hope, in that people can keep escalating, and in that just that feeling of, yes, we can.
Do you have anything to add, Lear?
I mean, a lot of what you're saying just really resonates, that is how it happens. You start by protecting one thing, and you end up questioning everything. Why are prairie dogs being killed? Why do people hate kangaroos? And you end up having a huge analysis about everything that's gone wrong on this planet. And I think it's also just so incredible to watch other people resist, because that does inspire that. When you see it, then you know that you can do it too. And I'm, of course, reminded of the great quote from the suffragist Millicent Fawcett, who said, courage calls to courage.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely.
Well, that makes a nice segue to the next question, which is, do you have heroes? If so, who are some of your heroes? Why them? And how do they become your heroes? Anybody go first?
I have to think for a minute.
When I was a kid, most of my heroes were from books, but they were incredibly important to me. And it was always about the theme of resistance, that they were characters. I mean, they weren't real people, but they resisted everything that I saw and hated in the world. And it really showed me that it was possible, that I could be that person when I got older too. And it's so important to give that to children as well. And then when I got a little older, you know, learning more history, there's so many moments where you learned about something, and there's just that relief, you know, that somebody somewhere resisted. I'll never forget being in, 15 years old and learning about, some of the resistance to the Nazis in Germany. And I, you know, didn't know that much about that period of history, but it just was such a relief to hear that, there were people who stood up to these, you know, to like the worst horror ever. There were actually people who did it. And it just soothed my soul to know that even in, you know, the worst kinds of situations, that people would still stand up and fight, stand up for their dignity, protect their children, protect their communities, do what they can, even though they knew that they were going to die. And that, of course, those kinds of things are always just incredibly inspiring and moving, I think, to all of us. So yeah, learning all of that from history, whatever movement. I also remember being incredibly moved by the struggle of the suffragists. There was there's a book you can get. It's called Shoulder to Shoulder. That's a history told in the words of the women themselves. It's mostly just a compilation of their letters and then news articles back and forth to each other and their journals about what they were doing and why. And then that was turned into a series by the BBC that was also called Shoulder to Shoulder. And you can't get it now. It's impossible because it was only on DVD, and they never made the leap to putting it on like a CD. So it's like a dead format, but it was the most incredible. It was all fictionalized, but it was all real. And I was only about 10 when that was on. It was on, remember, Masterpiece Theater. So it was on that. And I was just old enough that I was allowed to stay up and watch it. And it was two things. It was incredibly horrible watching what they all went through just to get the vote. And, you know, you watch the entire, like, they build this movement and their bonds with each other. And then they become more militant because nothing they do is working. And then finally that moment comes when they decide, well, we're going to go to jail. And then we're going to resist in jail. Like, we have to keep going. We're not going to give in. And so then they're tortured in jail. They're force fed. And the movie, the series showed in pretty graphic detail what that was. And I was still this pretty young kid. And there were two things. One was the horror of that, just watching these women be force fed with the tubes down, you know, up their noses. And it was horrendous watching it. But also, even at 10 years old, knowing that's like, well, if I had been alive then, I would have had to be one of them. I wouldn't have let other women endure that and not joined. I would have had to do it. So it was a sort of relief, like, oh, thank God we have the vote, so I don't have to do that. But like, just knowing that about myself, that it was just, I would be one of those women. There's no way that I could back down. If somebody else was going to step forward and take the hit for the tribe, I would have done it too. So anyway, that was an incredible thing for me to learn about when I was a kid. So, and just like that, you know, there's so many stories where you find a character from history, or, you know, even a fictional character. Learning about Harriet Tubman, I had a book when I was a kid that was called Runaway Slave, that was a biography of Harriet Tubman, but it was the same deal. Like, first you have to absorb just the horror of what slavery was and still is. And then here's this incredible person who resisted and resisted and resisted to her dying day. And she was just such an inspiration. So those are some of my heroes.
So before you two go on, I'm wondering, who are a couple of the fictional heroes from your childhood? Well, I'm thinking of I'm thinking of some of the kids in the Narnia series.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then there's
the Lord of the Rings.
The Lord of the Rings.
Frodo.
So what's so embarrassing about that?
I was Frodo. Well, people roll their eyes about.
No, so that's okay. That's okay.
Totally, though. I mean, the thing about Frodo is he's 4 feet tall. He's got nothing on his side but his bravery and his determination. And him and Sam get it done. Like, no matter how small you are, you have to resist. That's really what's at the heart of that story.
So name more, because I named those.
another fiction one?
Yeah.
Well, nobody's ever read this book but me, but there was a book called Jade, and it was by a woman named Sally Watson. And she wrote a whole series of children's books that have sort of fallen by the wayside. But Jade was my favorite because she was a pirate. The story is she's in Virginia and, you know, in America, and the family next door are, they have they're keeping foxes in cages. I don't know whether I can't remember exactly why, but she goes next door and she lets the fox go because she can't stand it. And this is the final straw in her family. And they're just like, you're uncontrollable. You don't listen to what we tell you to do. You're always breaking the rules. And it's like page by page six, she's already laid out like what white people are doing to black people is what men are doing to women and what humans are doing to animals. And it's so clear. This book was written in like 1964. And I was just like amazed reading this book because it was like, this is so it. This is exactly true. So her family sends her off to, you know, kind of be tamed. I think it's in Barbados maybe, where she has an uncle and they send her, you know, from England, from Virginia down to those colonies, and they're determined to turn her into a lady. And she just, every step of the way, she fights them. They try to make her wear stays, like a corset, and she cuts it up with a pair of scissors, and then they punish her for that. And then she cuts all her hair off, and then they punish her for that. And like, it just keeps going. And like, no matter what they do to her, she won't give in. And then, oh no, there's smallpox or something. So everybody, they're going to send her back. So they put her back on a boat to flee the island before she gets sick. And then the boat gets attacked by pirates. So she joins the pirates and like she has these wild adventures all about like fighting the slave ships in the Atlantic. And like this whole story was absolutely, I was like 10 years old, 11 years old when I read this. And I was like, that's it. I'm going to be her. Like this is what I'm going to do with my life. So I had that story and that's why kids need stories. That's exactly it right there. Like you need some way to mold just your conception of who you're going to be as you face these terrible things.
Thank you. Okay, so you too.
Thanks, Leah.
I talked too long.
No.
No, it was really interesting. I've been sitting here trying to think who my heroes have been, and to be honest, I can't think of any straight off the cuff, and I'll probably think of them 5 minutes after I get off the phone from this interview. But noting something that Leah said, it was, I think for me, it was people who cared for animals. I read a lot of books when I was a kid about people who cared for animals. I distinctly remember one about a goldfinch being saved and a girl who rescued animals, and there was a goldfinch and she wanted to become a vet to help animals. And I went through a long time as a kid wanting to help animals. I was brought up with a lot of wildlife. My father he's still alive. He was 90 this year, but he spent all his life as a wildlife photographer. And a lot of my early childhood was going around national parks or coastal areas while my dad had a hide up on some kind of bird or penguins down on Phillip Island, and he would film through the hide. So it was always a part of my life. And so that was a big influence. I probably can't name one in particular. And I think the other thing in my life, I've been really taken or admire people who stand up with their own voice. And like you, Derek, are one of them, not afraid to speak your own voice. And I do admire that. It's interesting because being an actor, everyone thinks, oh, it doesn't matter. You can get up and you can say this and you can say that. But most actors actually are really shy. And to become an actor is a way of perhaps moving through that. And that's still something I very much want to find, is my own voice. But actually being an actor and having been given a script most of your life to do this or to do that still doesn't really allow you to express what you want to express. So in my life, I've always admired people who have that voice, who are not afraid to stand up and say how it is. And I hope that I can learn that through my life and hope to move towards that too. But looks like I might be running out of time, so I better get onto it. That's probably all I've got to add in that my influence of heroes were people who saved animals. or sage any wild places, actually, and people who have stood up and have completely stood behind what they say when it's been very, very different to what the other narratives that are out there in the world.
I just want to point out that the woman who says that she's still sort of looking for her voice is the same woman who has been standing up for kangaroos to men with guns.
I know, right?
Yeah, I know. It was really hard, you know, that was really important for me to do that. And I can do that. Actually, I don't even think about it when it comes to kangaroos. Like, I don't even really think about it. It just sort of happens. But in some other areas, I might not be as sure, perhaps. And if I'm not as sure, then I'll probably just be a bit more reticent. And for some reason, I'm totally sure about kangaroos and some other things. But, yeah, on the whole, sometimes I just wish I could not be really so afraid to say what I want.
Thanks. How about you, Deanna? Thank you for that.
No, it's,
I mean, all of you are examples of heroes in my life, and you too, Fiona, of course.
Oh, thank you.
And I just think, I think anybody who's willing, like even Edward Snowden, I mean, that took a lot of people who just say, I am not going to stand by while this happens, and I'm going to, you know, try to make a change. And that, and definitely like the reason why I do what I do is because I read Derek's books, and I felt for the first time in my life like I am not crazy, and that this culture is crazy, and that life is worth fighting for. And so I mean, I there's so many people like Dar Jamal, just like a lot of people that I see as heroes are people who have been able to touch me. Just because where I'm at with words, and then I feel like I'm justified in doing what I'm doing, because it is really hard to go out there and be hated by a lot of people, which it seems like all of us know that feeling for standing up for those who don't have a voice, the earth, or, you know, women, or, you know, people who are stuck in the sex trade, or the prairie dogs who are sitting out there watching everybody get slaughtered. And then people in the history like Tecumseh and everybody who we have seen and who have stood up, and, you know, Malcolm X, and just there's so many examples out there of people who have stood up and then been able to have the force to keep going. And maybe it is kind of like what I feel, and you, Fiona, too, where we don't really have a choice when we're seeing something that we feel so strongly in love with being hurt. And that came a lot for me, the realization of that that's okay, and that we should be angry, and that we should love but we should do anything we can for those we love, came a lot from Derek, and watching you two, Derek and Lier, stand up to everybody who tries to do just who tries to break down your argument that's about things that aren't even really important to me, not like life on this planet, but to always stay true. You've always been like who you say you are, and you have this great integrity. So that's something that I picture in the qualities of a hero as well.
Well, thank you.
Hear, hear.
Okay. The next question. And because Deanna went first once and Lier went first once, I'm going to put you on the hot seat, Fiona. Okay. The question is, did you ever witness a miracle?
I don't know if I have, actually, except for the miracle, I guess I could only think of, yes, the little miracles of life when the little chickens are born, or the magpies and all the birds that are born in spring, baby animals, things that are born and created. I guess they're little miracles. I guess when you say a miracle, you kind of think of a really big thing. That's what my first thought was, you know, this big sort of miracle. But I think there are probably more of little miracles every day that I notice.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. If I were to answer this question, I think I would I would say, you know, parasitic wasps or I'll tell this story real fast. Somebody had a freezer dumped on their land, and this freezer had some rotten meat in it, and I was tasked with removing the freezer, and I opened the freezer and there was, oh, it smelled so bad. But the point is that within a minute, there were hundreds of flies there. And within 10 minutes, there was a vulture circling overhead. And the vulture had been beyond the tree shortened horizon before I opened the freezer. So the point is that the vulture was at least a mile or two away in the air. The molecules of rotting meat had to go up in the air, get smelled by the vulture, and it shows up in 10 minutes. That's a miracle. And the flies too. Flies being there literally within a minute when there hadn't been any flies around before. And the same with the parasitic wasps. There were some aphids. There were aphids on some plants indoors. I put them outdoors and some parasitic wasps showed up within, like there were some there within minutes. So they smelled the aphids or smelled the plants giving off the scent. Well, aphids themselves are miracles. Mm-hmm. Aphids are born pregnant, which is pretty extraordinary. Wow. You think there's problems with youth pregnancy in your town. Anyway, so that's yeah, I think there's miracles like that. Sorry, I'll shut up now. Deanna or
Yeah, I think it, like there, it makes me think like everything's a miracle. Maybe minus this culture. And that's probably miraculous in its own strange and depressing way. But yeah, I mean, like the sunrise, the sunset. Mm. And when you were talking about, I mean, all the trees, like there's trees here that I always just, you know, can't believe, like just gape at when I see the lightning that has just formed them, like that struck them. And then they grew in these weird, beautiful, like stretched out ways, almost looking like a dancer or something. And you can see where the lightning had struck right through that trunk, and they're still alive and still these beautiful, mm-hmm. like pine trees just miraculously formed by the lightning. And I don't know, almost everything that I look at in nature and is a miracle to me. And I always just have to sit and stare at it and kind of just recognize that amazing fact that we're here alive on this mm-hmm. beautiful, you know, miraculous planet. And I love the fact of you talking about an animal, the freezer. And it reminds me, I remember I did a time-lapse video of a horse that we had that died. She got colic. We put him on the land and it filmed the horse from the beginning of the time that we put it on the place to the end. And it showed the horse turn into bones from all of the different animals that came and feasted on the horse. So it showed like the progression. It was put down into like 7 minutes or something. You could watch all the bears and the fox and the birds and the coyotes and just the insects and everybody who fed off of this big horse. But yeah.
I remember seeing that video. I loved it.
It was fun.
Yeah.
Speaking of miracles and smelling meat, I read that bears can smell a dead animal from 10 miles away.
Gee.
Yeah, I have
a buzzard smelled it, for the vulture smelled it from at least that far, so I would believe
yes. it. Yeah, and I had a goat that died this summer, and within 5 minutes, the first bear that I saw of the year was right there, and he was peeking over the rocks, and I thought of that because I heard you say how the sense of smell that the bears had, and I was like, wow, that was pretty quick.
I guess I want to say one more thing about miracles, which is it stuns me how. I want to tell two stories. One is that it stuns me how there's all these different completely alien intelligences, you know, the bear's experience of life is completely different than ours, and a pine tree's experience of life is completely different than ours, but they're all sentient. They all have their own experiences. And and then I was having a conversation with a friend of mine one day a few years ago about, and he mentioned, he's a fisheries biologist, and he mentioned that sharks have their skin is evolved to be the perfect roughness to minimize drag in the water as they swim. And I know that this guy attends church, and I didn't know what he thought about church or, you know, sort of a Christian God or anything. And I said, so do you believe in some sort of intelligent design? Because that's really smart. And his answer was, there is great intelligence in time. And I think it's just, it's, or I saw a video just a couple days ago of somebody put increasingly small holes into a piece of wood and then filmed a goshawk flying through those holes. And the goshawk could conform itself. So there was food on the other side, and the goshawk would conform itself to the shape. He would turn the shape sideways. He would do, and it was just miraculous what a goshawk can do as it flies through a forest. I mean, that's where it came from. And it's just extraordinary to me. Anyway, so Lier, miracles.
Well, I had a duck named Miracle because she nearly died when she was a tiny little baby, and all the other, everybody else from that little, they all died, the ducks and the, and half the geese died too. It was a really horrible experience. But as they were struggling for their lives, and I'm sitting there with like an eyedropper every hour trying to keep them alive, they were absolutely in no shape to eat. But what it suddenly occurred to me that on the day that I stopped being a vegan, the first thing that I ate was tuna fish, and I came back to life eating that tuna fish. And I thought, there's something there for this duck. And so I opened a can of tuna fish in the kitchen, and I took some of the water from that can so it would have some of the, I don't know what you want to call it, like the energy of the fish in there. I was like, she just needed a hit of chi, essentially, some life force. And I put that in the eyedropper, and I gave it to the duck. And within like 3 seconds, she was fully alive again. Like it brought her right back. I was like, well, that's what you needed, was some other life force. Yeah. And that was it. She pulled through. And so her name was Miracle, because it really was a miracle that she survived, but it was the tuna fish that did it. So life needs life. There's, you know, that's the thing. So anyway, it worked. So go ahead.
Okay. So the next question, and we have about 15 minutes left. So maybe two questions, or maybe one, whatever. Are there things you desperately want to communicate to others, either those close to you or to society at large? If yes, what?
Who wants to go?
I find it so interesting, and perhaps this, just if this were, I suspect that if this were three men instead of three women, we would, instead of there being a silence while each person waits for the other to go first, there would be lots of people going, so actually.
I think it's difficult because I can't see any faces. Yeah. And usually where you can read people's faces when they're going to say something. So you don't want to kind of jump in if somebody's thinking to start. That's way so difficult to talk to people when you can't see their faces.
Tell Fiona and Deanna your story about
So we, in English, we have that, you know, everybody says between words, like between phrases. Those are called conversational markers, and a lot of cultures have that. So if you hear somebody speaking German or speaking French or whatever, you know, you'll hear a different little or ee or whatever their little syllable is. But the reason that we have those is because it's our way of saying, okay, there's a space between these words. I'm trying to collect my thoughts. Do not interrupt me. I still have the floor. And what's interesting about that is that there are a few cultures that don't have those markers, and they have a completely different style of communication. And in my experience, the people who have those kind of cultures, it's all the Native Americans that I know. Usually there's, like, if you're in a council or in the sweat lodge or something, the oldest person will speak first. And then the next oldest person speaks, and then maybe the next oldest person. So you have like the 90-year-old people speaking first, and then the 85-year-olds, and then the 70-year-olds. And you have the floor for as long as you want it. And it's considered so incredibly rude to interrupt people that when they're done speaking, there will be this long 30-second, 45-second, 1 minute of silence. And those of us who did not grow up in that culture, it's like, it just drives you insane. You're like, wow, I really have to learn to just sit still. And everybody just, you just wait. And then when it's very, very apparent that that person is done, then the next person can speak. And you, it's so rude to interrupt. So they don't have conversational markers because they're not constantly inserting themselves into the other people's speech. Like, it's just a completely different way to communicate.
It's so interesting because when you're saying that, I'm thinking too about our culture and how we don't like to listen. And that would go further even to what I would want to scream out to everybody is like, listen to other than human voices. And I think like when you're talking about circle, it reminds you too, because it's hard for me too. It's hard for me to sit there and be like just listening to what somebody's saying and not thinking about where I want to interject. And I think that's a problem. That's a huge problem for all of us in this culture, you know?
Yeah. And I just want to say the counterpoint to that is the kind of culture that I grew up in the, you know, Northeast kind of urban area of the United States. It tends to be a lot of, you know, that culture was really formed by a lot of the immigrants from sort of around the Mediterranean area. And it's just a completely different style of communicating because everybody talks all at once over each other, constant interruptions. And that's how you tell people, I love you and I'm engaged. You know, it's like that it from the outside, if you didn't grow up in that, it probably feels like people are fighting and screaming over each other, but it wasn't. It really is how you express affection. It's, you know, I'm listening and I care about what you're saying and that's why I'm interrupting. So it's just a completely different meaning. And I've run into this problem. And remember there was this one group of us, a radical feminist, we used to always meet like twice a year. And, you know, we'd have these little breakout sessions and it was completely falling apart. And it was because of these different conversational styles. And when we finally said it out loud, everybody could kind of breathe a sigh of relief. It's like, so we have three different things going on. We've got the all at once, total free for all. And then we've got the, okay, everybody raise their hands, kind of, you know, we'll moderate it some. And then we have like the really heavily moderated where only one person's going to speak, you know, and we really keep track of who's going to be speaking. And none of these things are particularly better. It just sort of depends who you are and where you're from. And so those of us who really were from that sort of that same sort of urban Northeast culture was like free for all. That's just what I do. And then all the women who were from like the Midwest, especially the upper Midwest, it was way more just, you know, very much more polite and it wasn't all that interrupting. And then we had, you know, a few women who actually were from a Native American background and they were like, you people are crazy. Like they just, they could not believe how we talked. It was like, this just doesn't even make any sense. And I'm like, yeah, this is just a clash of cultures, but you know, just saying it out loud and like helping everybody make a decision about how we were going to move forward made all the difference. Cause then at least we could acknowledge like people aren't being rude. And also they're not being unengaged. Like either way, you know, people were getting their feelings hurt and it was like, just, it's just different. Like we just all have a different home place that we came from. And that includes a different communication style. So we got completely off track of those cards though.
That's okay. That's kind of the point. When I was, when I was a teenager, there was one of my friend's fathers used to yell all the time at the kids and everybody. And it used to terrify me until one day I was over there for dinner and he said, please pass the potatoes, except he yelled. And I just at that moment I realized that him yelling does not mean anger. It's just
what he does.
He's a loud person. After that, he would yell, you know, Tom was my friend. He would yell, Tom, get in here. And it's like, I wouldn't freak out because Tom wasn't freaking out. I mean, Tom had been, you know, having this father who yelled constantly since he was born. Anyway, so I don't even remember the question. The question was something about, oh, are there things that you want to desperately communicate? So I'll go first on this one. Okay. What I desperately want to communicate, a couple things. One is, the entire world is alive and sentient and, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about aphids or mountains or rivers or orangutans or, Christmas Cactus or whomever, their lives are as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me, or kangaroos or prairie dogs or tuna or ducks. Doesn't matter. And the other thing is that this way of life will not last. And when it's over, I would prefer that there is more life left on the planet rather than less. So those are the two things I really want to communicate. Well, that was a conversation stopper.
Yeah. Maybe it's just because I feel so far away over here. I guess there's similar things that I want to communicate. I'd like to communicate more from the aspect of the wild ones and wild places, and they don't have a voice, and how I can bridge that gap to make people more aware, and I still don't know in what way, but I will I'll obviously find out soon. I'll just keep plugging away.
Deanna Lear?
Well, I feel the same. I mean, I'd have the same ultimate goals as what you are, want, desire as what you are saying, Derek, where people would understand that all of life is sentient, and that, you know, the way that we're living is destroying that those sentient beings all around us, and that of the forests who, if I were the forest, and I would probably silence myself to everybody too, but for people to start telling different stories that are built up from love of land and life, and to recognize that we've got to stop allowing our life to be destroyed and, you know, killed. And hopefully, you know, just I always just wish people would get that point of where they could just listen to the land and understand the direction that we should be going in, because the land is screaming out help. That's what I hear. That's what I see in the plains and in all of the combustion engines around me, and just in the stories of everything.
Are you there, Deanna?
I don't hear her.
I am. Can you hear me now?
You went blank for a minute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's not your fault. Yeah. It's Skype.
I guess I just said, I wish everybody would hear the sounds of the land telling us to help them, because that's what I hear. And I wish people would help, because our way of living is not more important than life on this planet.
Thank you.
Do one more.
Okay, so
we've got 2 minutes.
We have just a couple minutes, and I'm going to ask something, and I'm going to tell you right off the top my answer to. Do you ever sing to the land where you live? If so, what songs? My answer briefly is no. I'm not. I find singing really moving, but for whatever reasons, I love listening to singing, especially communal voices, and I understand how it brings people together, but I'm not very good at it. I mean, I'm not very confident, and it makes me feel uncomfortable to sing. I feel like that's a failure of my own, but we don't need to get into that. So, do you ever sing to the land where you live? If so, what songs?
I sing to the land every day when I walk through the forest, and I have a million songs that I sing. And we don't have time, or I'd share one.
Okay, Fiona or Deanna? Or both? And Deanna, I should say?
Oh, I don't sing to the land, but I talk to the land. Not only the land, but everything that's within it and on it. I have many conversations, but not singing, more just conversation.
Yeah, and sometimes I do sing to the land, and when I do, I feel kind of vulnerable, and I just sing, Like it's not like a song. I always get songs stuck in my head, which I try to eliminate when I'm walking the land, but I have stood there before when I feel really, connected and just, I sing in songs of love, really. I don't know what the lyrics are now. I just kind of let the words come out. That doesn't happen very often. And I feel real vulnerable when I do it, but I'd also have done it before and felt like it was good.
Well, thank you for that. And
thanks, Deanna.
I'm looking for like one really, looking for one final question. I'm.
I think we're out of time.
I'm 6:50. I want to do one more question.
One more.
Okay, I guess this one. How many wild animals do you see daily? How many wild animals do you have a daily relationship with?
I see a lot of wild animals daily. I don't think that I have a personal relationship with any of them because I can't really pull them all apart, but I see all kinds of birds. I see all kinds of little mammals. I see some very big mammals. But I also live, you know, surrounded by a bunch of acres of forest, so it's not strange that I would see so many wild animals.
Yeah, I'm really lucky too because I have the prairie dogs that we moved up here. They're sleeping right now. They go into torpor for a couple months when it gets cold, but the rest of the year they're always out there. And of course I'm surrounded by birds and elk and deer and bobcats. I've been seeing a lot this year, which I'm very grateful for because I've never had like a regular occurrence of seeing bobcats until this year. Yeah, I've seen mountain lions up here, bears, but I wouldn't say daily. I'd say prairie dogs most of the year, birds most of the year, and I'll usually see some deer.
Oh, and for me, probably where I am on a daily basis, it's mostly birds, a large variety of native birds here, king parrots, magpies, rosellas, sometimes sparrowhawk comes, it all goes quiet, deathly quiet. There's galahs or cockatoos, lots and lots of parrots who I do feed as well, which I probably shouldn't, but especially cockatoos. But they're hungry because people mow the grasses at this time of year, you know, summer. It's just all the grasses are heading and it all just gets mowed. So all these animals who rely on seed at the end of the day don't have much to eat. So I do contribute to that. But I'd say on a daily basis it's mostly birds. And on other days there are wallabies and kangaroos and wombats or a koala. And of course, there's plenty of non-native animals as well.
So, will you tell two stories real quick? One of them is the story you told me about, and don't name a name on this, but the story you told me about somebody who has a kangaroo who comes into their house and raids their food. Do you remember that story? And then the other one is I know I'm using a loaded word here that I don't really mean. I mean this affectionately, but tell a naughty story or two about corellas or cockatoos or parrots or some other.
Have we got enough time?
Do speed
talk. I'll try and do it quickly. Okay. So I have a friend who lives she's only about 5-6 minutes away, and she's a wildlife shelter. And so there's several kangaroos that the first ones that she released onto her property, she backs onto about, she's 30 acres and backs onto State Forest. And those kangaroos have never really left home. One in particular, called Lily, has never left home. She goes out every day and is wild with the wild kangaroos, but at night she comes back. So she comes into the house, and on many occasions I've been there at night and there's Lily and there's all of us. And Lily will make her way around the kitchen, picking the fruit off the fruit bowl, so we invariably have to move that out of her reach. And then she's been known to make it into the bathroom and unzip bags of things and have a look through all sorts of bathroom stuff, because kangaroos actually really like toothpaste. I don't know if it's the minty taste or not. And they say in when they made shows like Skippy, which was a huge show about a young boy and his pet kangaroo in a national park. It was in the 1960s. It was very popular. But one of the reasons they used to get the kangaroo to move its mouth was because they put toothpaste on it. So it must be the menthol flavour. So that's Lily. And she's always got her nose into something. And when you go around there, she'll be sprawled out in a, either on the floor or in a dog bed, and then might make her way out into the night later on. The other one, naughty stories about cockatoos. They're very persistent cockatoos. They're incredibly smart, but they know when I go up the back and feed the chooks. So they have a scout on me most of the day. He'll either be in the front tree or the back tree, watches my every movement. And when I haven't been up the back to give the chooks their food in the time that they think I should have, the scout and about 10 others start landing on the guttering of the house and peer. They actually bend down. They hang right down off the guttering and they peer in the windows to actually see what I'm doing and just stare at me until I eventually give in. So there's many more, but the cockatoos, yeah, they can be quite naughty.
I would like to thank all of you for your work in the world, and I would like to thank you for being on the program, for playing. This was really fun, for me at least. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Deanna Meyer, Fiona Cork, and Lierre Keith. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.